I am Nick Hodge, co-owner of Digest Publishing and publisher of Daily Profit Cycle, among many other publications, and I'm without my co-host, partner, and co-owner, Gerardo Del Real, this week, but I have a special guest for you for the 343rd episode of Investing in Bizarro World. That's Mr. Curtis Moore. Curtis, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you?
I'm very well. Curtis is the Senior Vice President of Marketing and Corp Dev at Energy Fuels, which some of you will know has been a longtime holding of Underground Alpha and a personal stock holding of mine. So just a little bit of disclosure there that I've been a shareholder for a while, and it's been quite a good year for you, Curtis. Before we get into the critical metals and the Trump administration and all the good things that Energy Fuels has going on, I had to ask you a more important question. Did you get out elk hunting this year?
No, unfortunately, I did not. Things have been so busy at Energy Fuels. I have not had a lot of time to take a lot of time for myself over the last year, year and a half or so. I've been, as we'll talk about, I've been spending a lot of time in DC, a lot of time, and just trying to, show people, and again, show people what we're able to do in the critical mineral space, which we're doing right now. So next year I'll get out there.
Heck yeah. It's been a while since you and I have seen each other. I remember 10 or 12 years ago seeing you every year at the New Orleans Investment Conference, mm-hmm. where you would be diligently sitting at your booth. We've come a long way since those days in the critical metals and mining space, especially in the United States. And I was just there a couple of weeks ago, but you're actually at a conference now, or a couple of conferences. Me where you are. Can you tell me where you are?
Yeah. So the Arizona Mining Association had their annual conference down in Tucson over the last couple of days, and I was down there, and it was a great conference. Just honestly, Energy Fuels was certainly one of the big topics down there, just because of the successes that we have had at our Pinyon Plain uranium mine up in the northern part of the state. And there was lots of mining companies, mainly copper, of course, being Arizona and all. Lots of elected officials at the state level. There was an official from the White House joined in and gave a talk yesterday. It was a great event. And then yesterday I drove back up here to Scottsdale, where it's the conference of the Western Governors Association, which is basically, you might guess, it's an association of Western governors. The chair of the Western Governors Association is Governor Spencer Cox from Utah, who is a big, big supporter of Energy Fuels for a variety of reasons. But, the White Mesa Mill, where we process this uranium, and we're also starting to process rare earths, is in his state. And we're preparing to make a big, big expansion at that facility here over the next couple of years. It's probably going to be the biggest investment in certainly Southern Utah history, just because of the scale of what we're looking to do. It's essentially going to make us as big or bigger than like an MP Materials or a Linus in the rare earth space with that expansion. And so, of course, the governor could not be more supportive. And so here supporting him at his conference.
Awesome. Utah's really coming on strong. I'm involved in a couple of assets there in Utah. They're really friendly on the permitting side and open for business, as it were. You already mentioned one of the first things I want to talk about. That's uranium production. Mm-hmm. So I've been following the story. You guys are producing some pretty low-cost pounds there from Pinyon Plains. Can you give me a little snapshot of what you've been up to there and what the production profile looks like, and maybe tie in some of the things you're hearing about uranium either at the conferences or from your trips to DC?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that mine, I'll tell you, we thought it was going to be a good mine, but it's better than even our previously high expectations. And as you know, in the mining world, that is pretty rare to have a mine actually exceed your expectations. This mine has been around for a long time. The deposit has been known and understood for probably the last 40 years. But through just a variety of permitting hurdles and NGO lawsuits and lawfare, and then just pricing, it has not been able to go into production until early last year. So we've really started to scale up production at that mine here over really since about last spring. It's just turning out to be higher grade, lower cost, and larger than we originally thought. I think the original resource estimate showed that the project had about 3 million pounds of uranium, so pretty small. Now, we always thought that it was going to be bigger than that. That's just kind of the the nature of these deposits. They're really difficult to drill out. And so it's difficult to get the data that you need to be able to upgrade your resources into, measured, indicated, or reserve status. But the history of these types of deposits is that once you've got a couple of good drill holes, you know, even if you only have an inferred resource or something, you're 90% sure that you've got a good mine there and a good deposit. So you go ahead and you sink your shaft, and you get down there, do more underground drilling, and start mining. And so Pinyon Plain is just kind of like what we thought. We haven't put out a new resource estimate or a reserve estimate, but I can tell you it's going to be a lot bigger than the 3 million pounds that we had out there. Mm-hmm. Again, the zones that we have identified, they're just bigger and higher grade and more extensive than we thought. And so we're confirming that now.
So this is a hard rock asset. This isn't an ISR, because you said you sunk a shaft. Did you guys build this entire project, or is this a past producer that's come back online?
It's never been in production. Again, it's got a long, long history. In fact, our CEO, Mark Chalmers, when he was a young mining engineer, he started driving this shaft back in the 1980s. he drove the shaft down to a whopping 50 feet. And then I think that the mine got injuncted just through, the NGOs of the world. And then the price dropped, and it just kind of, would come back and then go away, come back and go away. We sank the shaft to its current depth, which is about 1500 feet, at about 2017 or 18 or so, or maybe 16, 17, 18. And so we drove it down there. And so we were kind of doing more drilling, more preparation, more underground development work and that sort of thing. And then it got to the point where the prices came back. We've got some contracts with the domestic utilities. And so we put the mine into production again last year of 2024, really ramped it up here early 25. And now it's really hitting its stride. I mean, it's honestly, we're producing ore out there at a clip of about 2 to 2.5 million pounds per year right now of U3O8. Mm-hmm. That all then has to get shipped, to the White Mesa Mill in Utah. It's being stockpiled. We also just started a uranium processing run with this Pinyon Plain ore back in October, and that's going to run through about March or so of this year. We'll probably produce on the range of about 1.5 million pounds of U3O8 from that run. We'll still have some more ore to process if we want to, but we are, I would say, kind of at a bit of a processing crossroads right now as a company, because this rare earth thing is coming at us, right? Mm-hmm. And so We're in discussions with both commercial and government entities about do we just keep processing uranium and sell that into what are pretty, they're good uranium markets, not great, but they're good. Or do we switch over to do rare earth production kind of the middle of next year? So I can't tell you where that's going to go right now. I don't know, honestly.
Okay. Maybe we'll flesh some of that out before we jump away from uranium. I said it was low cost. Can you talk a little bit about the cost of the uranium you're producing there?
Yep. Our costs are in the $23 to $30 per pound range.
Yeah. And
extremely low cost. Now, that doesn't include a lot of old sunk costs that have been, that have happened out there over the last 40 years. Kind of on a go forward basis, it's $23 to $30 a pound. That's what's going to hit our bottom line. And so the way you're going to see that kind of manifested in our financial statements is that those costs kind of get blended into our current inventory of uranium. And our current inventory, it's made up of kind of a little bit of past production that we've done over the last several years. We've made some uranium purchases at times that we thought where the price was good. And so right now our cost of goods sold is $50 to $55 per pound on our books. Mm-hmm. And so when you see sales and revenues, that's the cost of goods sold. But as we kind of blend in this $23 to $30 per pound material out of Pinyon Plain and sell that, we take a weighted average cost that then you're just going to see our costs just drop, hopefully down into the low to mid 30s as all this Pinyon Plain stuff gets mined and processed.
And just to remind viewers, I think the last time I checked spot last evening, it was something like $76 mm-hmm. a pound of uranium. You mentioned some contracts with utilities. What prices are those at?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't disclosed the actual prices. Now, if you've looked at our sales over the last couple of years, you can see that we've been selling in kind of the high 60s to low 70s, mid 70s per pound range. Mm-hmm. We sign hybrid contracts. These are the types of contracts that like a Cameco signs, where a portion of your price is based on the spot price in effect at the time of delivery, and a portion of your price is fixed at the time the contract was signed. Most of the contracts that we're delivering into right now were signed in the 2022 timeframe. And at that time, the spot price of uranium was in the 40 and the long-term price was in the $45 to $50 per pound range. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that, and we did better than that, but it's not like we have a fixed price of $75 per pound. But again, you know, we're making great margins on that stuff when you're producing it for $23 to $30 per pound. So we also have some other contracts that we've signed more recently that have much, much better pricing on them. So that'll get blended into our portfolio. And again, with Pinyon Plain and the amount of pounds that we think we're going to get out of there, we're going to be cash flowing very nicely out of that mine for the next several years.
Excellent. So let's follow that ore. It comes out of the mine there in Arizona. You mentioned it goes over to the White Mesa Mill in Utah, mm-hmm. where it's stockpiled and processed. There's a lot of those mills around America, isn't there, where you can process uranium?
Nope. In fact, there are really none. You have, it is the only mine. It is the only conventional uranium mill that's operating in the U.S. today. There are two other conventional uranium mills that theoretically could come into production in the next several years. You have a UEC that now owns the Sweetwater Mill in Wyoming. That could theoretically come online, but those two mills won't compete against each other because they're 700 miles apart.
Geographically totally far apart. Yep.
Yeah. They're totally different districts. And then you have the Shootering Canyon Mill that's owned by Anfield. That's a little west of White Mesa. So, you know, again, that theoretically could come online in the next several years. But again, that's a whole different mining district over there, too. So,
yeah. And theoretical is not actual. And I like actual, which is one of the reasons that I'm an Energy Fuel shareholder, and not just because of the uranium. Right. So a lot of folks I talk to and when I tell the Energy Fuel story, don't realize everything the White Mesa Mill can do. You want to talk about the investment you've put into that lately and the other things you can process there?
Absolutely. I mean, the one that really jumps off the page is rare earths. You know, back in the 2019, 2020 time period where, you know, uranium was still just kind of languishing and not really sure what's going to go on there. We started kind of looking at some other materials and other minerals that maybe we could produce and see if there was a way to leverage our capacity, our licenses, our expertise, our people out there. And the one that really, really rose to the top was rare earth elements. I call these my dirty little secrets of rare earths. there is a lot of misunderstandings about rare earths and a lot of just information out there that's just not totally accurate. It's a very, very niche kind of an industry. And it's hard to compete. I mean, there's a big reason why a lot of Western companies have not done very well in the rare earth industry. One of the big ones is that every single rare earth mineral naturally is radioactive. It's got uranium and thorium bound up in that mineral. And so as you start to process that mineral and you start to extract the rare earths and get rid of the impurities, including the radioactive impurities, you start to get uranium and thorium and radium and things building up in your process streams and your tailings. I would say every single non-Chinese rare earth company around the world has run into a radioactivity problem at some time, whether it's Linus, whether it's, you know, Molycorp/MP, really anybody. And that doesn't matter. Monazite, Xenotime, Basmosite, Ionic Clays, they all have uranium and thorium. We have a uranium mill.
That's one of the reasons we were content as a nation to export the production of that stuff to China is not just the emissions, but as you just said, the radioactive components that come out of it. It's a dirty process. You guys have solved that. You're in production. Mm-hmm. And you said there's a lot of misconceptions. I wanted to dive into that for a second because I hear a ton about MP Materials. I'm familiar with that company. I followed the Molycorp story years ago. I see what's happened recently with the Trump administration taking a direct stake in MP Materials, something like $400 million, if memory serves, and providing them a price floor as well. Yep. And that grabs headlines. And like you said, it's a very niche industry. So what folks don't really know is the difference between light rare earths and heavy rare earths and what those are and why that matters. Can you inform us a little bit about that?
Yep, absolutely. So the rare earths are 17 elements, metallic elements on the periodic table, the lanthanides plus yttrium and scandium, and they're categorized as light and heavy, or sometimes light and middle and heavy based on their atomic weight. So the lights are generally lanthanum, cerium, neodymium, praseodymium. The mids are samarium, europium, and gadolinium. And then the heavies are terbium, dysprosium, holmium, and kind of on down the line. Mm-hmm. And they all have different applications and different uses. The main commercial applications for these rare earths, and this applies to two of the lights and two of the heavies, are magnets. And so these are very, very powerful magnets used in a whole host of technologies like electric vehicles and hybrid electric vehicles. A lot of people don't realize that hybrids actually use just as many rare earths as pure electric vehicles. Hmm. Advanced robotics needed in a bunch of applications and advanced manufacturing and all that to create those very fast, precise, strong movements. Those are all rare earth magnets creating that. Certain renewable energy technologies, but then a lot of military and defense technologies. So the main commercial application are neodymium iron boron magnets, and those use neodymium and praseodymium, which are the two main light magnet rare earths, and also
NdPr. Sorry to interrupt.
NdPr. Yep. Exactly. Yep. And terbium and or dysprosium, Dy and or Tb. That gives those magnets a little bit more strength and heat resistance and durability. So that's kind of the main commercial game for rare earths. Now, additional heavy rare earths, particularly the heavies that are subject to export controls by China, which they still are subject to export controls, by the way, despite all the buddy-buddy between the U.S. and China right now. There is no current evidence that China has removed the export controls on the heavy rare earths, and that includes terbium, dysprosium, yttrium, lutetium, scandium, some of these more obscure mm-hmm. rare earths, because they have very important uses in military systems and defense systems. And right now, there is really no source of these heavies besides China right now. And so that's really where the big game is, I would say, in rare earths, is on the heavies.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And that's, honestly, that's a big, let's say disadvantage that like a MP has. They don't really have heavies in their feedstock. I think they're great for NdPr, and, we're glad that the U.S. government is offering them support and all that. But I think there's going to have to be more done to secure heavy rare earths, because we don't have a non-Chinese source of heavy rare earths. I think Lynas is just starting to do something with dysprosium at their facility in Malaysia. But there's definitely no domestic source except Energy Fuels.
What's Energy Fuels doing with the heavies?
Yeah. So we are dealing with a different mineral than in MP Materials. Their deposit in California is called bastnasite. And bastnasite is a pretty good mineral for the light rare earths, but it's not very good for the heavies. We're dealing with a mineral called monazite, and also another one called xenotime to a lesser extent. And monazite and xenotime concentrates, which are produced as a low cost byproduct of heavy mineral sand mining, effectively titanium and zircon mining, they have heavies. And so our feedstock does have heavies. And so we last year we commercialized NdPr production at our White Mesa mill. Right now we're piloting the heavy rare earth separations. And right now we've probably produced 40 or 50 kilograms of high purity dysprosium oxide. We should have a kilogram or two of terbium oxide here shortly, samarium oxide probably, and maybe yttrium oxide not long thereafter. And what that's doing is going to inform our design for commercial heavy rare earth separations. And so we're kind of doing what I'd say is a small heavy separation circuit, commercial size, at our White Mesa mill that should be operational hopefully by about this time next year or soon thereafter, to produce terbium, dysprosium, maybe scandium, maybe yttrium oxides, hopefully in the next year or so.
That's awesome. Yep. Wonderful education. I appreciate that. And you have more ambitions in the rare earths and the heavies. Tell me about this Donald project I've been reading about.
Yeah. So the White Mesa Mill is a processing facility. You know, that's where we process it, but it's not a mine. So we need feedstock, and honestly, there's not a lot of monazite and xenotime in the United States. And so most of this stuff is in the Southern Hemisphere, honestly. And so, what these are titanium and zircon mines. So think about like a Tronox, think about an Iluka, think about, you know, Rio Tinto has this stuff. They produce these titanium and zircon minerals like ilmenite and rutile, zircon. They're kind of boring industrial materials for the most part. Of course, there's, you know, very important critical uses for titanium metal and zirconium metal and things like that. But most of those minerals go into like white paint and pigment and ceramics and, you know, kind of boring stuff, honestly. I mean, but there's this low cost byproduct that's full of monazite and xenotime that comes off of those operations, mainly in the Southern Hemisphere. So you reference our Donald project, and it is a heavy mineral sand project, shovel ready, fully permitted. If we had the financing and the offtake lined up, we could start construction out there tomorrow. And it's a heavy mineral sand project, and it is of particular importance because it has a lot of xenotime in the deposit, which is where the heavies are. And so it has, I would say, as good or better heavy rare earth distributions than really any other project in the world, including some of the ionic clay projects that get some buzz sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it is, of course, getting a lot of interest by both commercial and government customers. And then we also have our Toliara project in Madagascar and our Bahia project in Brazil, which we could talk about as well.
Go ahead. Sure.
Okay. So like I said, Donald is fully permitted, shovel ready, ready to go. Also has great distributions of the heavies. We're in that project on a joint venture with another Australian company called Astron. And so as a result of that, the economics aren't quite as good just as some of the other mineral sand projects we have. They're still very good and you still have the heavies. So that's why it's so important. But to get our costs down and to get our scale up, we have this project in Madagascar called the Toliara project, which is widely known and considered to be the biggest, best undeveloped heavy mineral sand project in the world. I mean, if you ask anybody in the titanium zircon industries, they know about Toliara. It's a monster. And it's still in some permitting. There was recently a military coup in Madagascar. Uh-huh. that we're still trying to work through all that. And so we're trying to get our final government approvals through there. Early indications are that things are going to be just fine with that project, but we still got to work through it carefully. But once that gets up and running here, hopefully in the next few years, that is really going to lower our cost of rare earth production and just really kick up our scale. And then you add in our Bahia project in Brazil, which is a little more exploration stage, but, it's a little smaller, lower capital. So that makes it a little easier to put into production. But once all three of those projects are up and running, we'll be able to produce on the order of 6,000+ metric tons of NdPr oxide per year, which is kind of the capacity of an MP Materials. Mm-hmm. We'll be, Linus out of Australia, they're producing, I believe, 6,000 or 7,000 tons per year of NdPr oxide. So we'll be right in that category as well. And we'll have really good concentrations of dysprosium and terbium and any other heavies that, you know, maybe the government might want. So I think we've got that scale of rare earth production right in our line of sight, and probably at a lower cost.
You've mentioned the government a couple of times. You just said that you're looking for financing and offtake, and you mentioned that you've been in Washington, D.C. A fair amount lately. I can only try to connect the dots in my head as to why you've been going to Washington. So one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was because of Washington. I mean, we saw when, Trump came in for his second administration, he started fast and furious with the executive orders to open up energy production, uranium production. We talked about the MP Materials deal. They're taking direct equity stakes. They're providing financing floors or price floors for some of these minerals. Can we just talk about that for a little bit? Yep. What are you seeing from the administration? What have you been going to DC for? As much as you can reveal, obviously, we don't want to cross any lines, but I'm very interested in that. And I know the listeners are very interested in that as well, because some of these stocks, including yours, which was $4+ earlier this year and has gone above 20, are getting great response because of what's happening at the at the federal government level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, I can't say too much about what's going on, but I will say that there is a great, great deal of support out of the Trump administration for domestic critical mineral, mining and processing projects. I think that you're going to see more deals besides the MP Materials deal. I do think that the MP Materials deal is a good is a good model for future deals. Though I do think that future deals will probably look a little different and have different nuances to them. And again, I can't tell you if or when or how Energy Fuels might get a deal. But certainly things like price floors are something that we are very, very interested in, because honestly, and I felt like I've been kind of a voice in the wilderness over the last 10 years when people ask me about what do we need to do to create uranium or rare earth or, you know, critical mineral production. And I said, you know, think to yourself, if you could give domestic companies a good price floor, that'll pretty much solve all problems. Now, mm-hmm. How do you create that price floor? How do you prevent inefficiencies, and how do you, you know, set that price floor to appropriate levels? I mean, you know, devils are in the details, but in a very basic sense, that's how you do it, right? Because that just takes all the power out of the hands of malign actors, right? And so, I was really glad to see that MP Materials got that, because that's really what it takes. And that's something certainly that we'd be very, very interested in. I do know that the administration is dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of proposals mm-hmm. across the spectrum on critical minerals, not just rare earths, but, you know, everything else. And they want to support all that. And they have kind of limited resources, right? And I'll tell you that of those thousands of proposals they're looking at, 99.9% of them are garbage. Well,
theoretical.
Yeah, maybe I earlier. Shouldn't say that, but I'll let your listeners decide who's garbage and who's not.
Sure.
But I'm just saying that they are very theoretical. They're highly unlikely to be successful. But if you're just, you know, a person in the White House or the DOW or the DOE, and you're looking at these proposals and they all look very good. Look, you've been in the mining sector as long or longer than I have. And there's lots of projects that just look amazing on paper. You've got very, you know, charismatic promoters and stuff that just make their projects sound like the greatest thing since sliced bread. But when you it'll never be a mine. And so that same dynamic is happening with DOW and the White House and all that. So with that being said, our strategy as a company is not only to talk about what it is that we're doing, but to also show them what we're doing. Hey, look, here's a kilogram of dysprosium oxide. Has anybody mm-hmm. else brought that to you?
Yep.
Here's NdPr oxide. Here's the stuff. And just to keep knocking off these milestones. And we are showing them, and they know they're very interested. So we'll see what comes out of that.
Great. Just a couple of more questions here. I want to get some more stuff out of you, because you have been selected for Fast 41 permitting mm-hmm. for the Roca Honda project. I was wondering if you could tell us what that process was like, what that means for you, and maybe a little bit about Roca Honda.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a great proof, I would say, of how serious the Trump administration is on getting domestic mineral production up and running. They actually reached out to us. This new permitting council. We didn't even ask for that. They kind of reached out to us. And they said, "Hey, would you be interested in I just think they went through all the projects that are going through, various permitting process through the Forest Service or the BLM or, you know, whatever the permitting agency is. And they just started reaching out and saying, "Hey, can we add you to this permitting dashboard?" And we said, "Absolutely." Now, there are kind of two categories of Fast 41 permitting. There's called the transparency category, and then there's called the I'm drawing a blank on the name of it. It's another category that is actually more expedited. We are currently just a transparency project where just they kind of put you up on a dashboard. They put kind of estimated timeframes for when certain milestones and when certain permits are going to get granted. If you get into that other category, that means that the agency has committed to a really tight timeframe for getting permitted. And I will tell you that Roca Honda will get onto that more expedited timeframe, but it's really up to us. we need to do an additional submission of our own on the EIS there. And so, but I think that there is a really good chance that we could have Roca Honda permitted in the next year. And hopefully get that up and running, because that's a big, wonderful, low cost uranium project that could come online right after Pinyon Plain is done in the early 2030s. Well, Roca Honda hopefully will come on sooner than that. But we have our Bullfrog project. That's another big uranium mine deposit that we're going to also get through Fast 41. We haven't even submitted for an EIS on that one yet, but we will shortly. And then we have two other breccia pipes, similar to Pinyon Plain in northern Arizona, which are same thing. We haven't even, you know, they were kind of, you know, we wanted to advance them at some point, but then all of a sudden Trump got elected and they go through all this Fast 41. So in a lot of respects, we've had to kind of get our own act together. And so, you know, and get those permits in and get that those processes started, get on that Fast 41 and get those things across the finish line here in the next couple of years.
Yeah. This has been great. Anything else we need to touch on with regard to the administration or the federal government that I've omitted?
I don't think so. Yeah, the support we're seeing is just kind of staggering, honestly. And also at the state level. I mean, like state of Utah is just unbelievably supportive. State of Arizona has been good. You know, it's I think people got the memo, you know, that we have got this tidal wave of energy demand coming at us. Right. And the new Cold War, I think the new arms race is going to be over energy and technology. And if we don't get our act together, China and others and or others are going to kick our butts. And so everybody across the political spectrum, I think, realize that.
I think it's about time. It's something that I've been pounding the table on for a long time as well. We're obviously critically dependent, sorry for the pun, but on these nations that aren't so friendly to us. And even when you strike trade deals like have been announced in recent weeks, they could always still pull the plug or cut you off, and those deals expire, etc. So winding up here, I want to switch gears to something that I'm actually really interested in that not a lot of people know that you do, and that's medical isotopes. You have a section about it on your website. Nobody talks about this. I guess I'll just stop there. Talk to me about the medical isotopes, how valuable they are, and what they're used for.
Yeah. So what we're talking about here is primarily radium. So in uranium deposits and also thorium deposits, and actually monazite, which we're getting our rare earths from, is a thorium mineral. There's a lot of thorium in monazite. And so you get so off of uranium and thorium decay, you get a couple of radium isotopes, radium 226 and radium 228.
You might have like a radon abatement system in your house if there's uranium in the soil. I have one here in my house where you have a fan that takes the radon out, right? So
that's what you're talking about. Yeah, I believe radon is a decay product of radium decay, right? Which starts as uranium decay. Look up the uranium or thorium decay chain. You'll just see all these different elements that uranium will turn into, and then those turn into something else. So if you go way down the uranium and thorium decay chains, you get to some other really, really obscure elements, things like lead 212 or like actinium 225. That are very short half-life alpha emitting elements. Okay. And so what pharmaceutical companies and scientists and others have figured out is that if you can stick one of those short half-life alpha emitting elements to a cancer cell, it'll kill the cancer cell and none of the surrounding healthy tissue. And so that is what we're talking about here. Is that they've actually gone through some early human trials on this, and it is having almost miraculous results. I mean, the very first human trial was a gentleman in Germany who had advanced stage 4 prostate cancer, where the doctors are kind of like, there's nothing more we can do for you. You know, go get your affairs in order and, you know, prepare to die in the next month or two. And then some researchers were working on this, and they gave him, I think it was 3 injections of this, cured of cancer. He's alive today. This was like 10 years ago, and cancer-free to this day. It's unbelievable, right? But where this the trick here, though, is that you need these pharmaceutical companies. They need radium. So radium is kind of like the precursor to those other elements that they need for these drugs. And there's really no source of radium out there. They've been doing human trials. You know, like the U.S. government and some other governments have little tiny bits of radium that they've been able to use for research, but that's all kind of running out. And so they're looking for sources of radium that's not Russia, not China, you know, and that sort of thing. Well, in our process streams, we have a lot of radium. And in fact, most of the radiation that comes off of our tailings at the White Mesa Mill is radon, which is from radium decay. So what we're working on is, how do we extract radium out of our process streams at the White Mesa Mill, which are right now we're just throwing away. Now, again, the trick here is that you're trying to recover, you know, grams or hopefully kilograms of radium out of hundreds or millions, hundreds of thousands or millions of tons of material, right?
Very small amounts.
That's,
yeah.
very, 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 very dilute. And so that's what we're trying to work on here, is how do you do that? Now, the payoff at the end of the day is extraordinary. We're talking millions of dollars per gram. Mm-hmm. potentially. So
that's why I'm interested. Yep.
Yeah. And so, you know, for instance, Pinyon Plain as a very high grade uranium deposit probably has, I don't know, 5 or 10 kilograms of radium just sort of dispersed throughout the deposit. You know, we're never going to recover all of it, but if we could recover a tenth of it, that's extremely valuable, right? Now, keeping in mind as well that, you know, that's what Marie Curie was working on 130 years ago.
Right.
And she was able to recover and concentrate radium. Well, if she could do it, I would like to think we could do it. And so, in fact, we're using some of the same techniques that she did. So now you have to be extremely careful with this stuff because radium is hot. You don't want to expose people to it.
Sure.
You know, so you're going to need, you know, hot cells and robots and other things to be able to do it. But if we can do it, the prize could be extraordinary.
It's amazing to me that radioactive materials, uranium, has turned into a savior for the energy space, for the decarbonization space, and yep. could eventually and ultimately turn into a cancer savior as well. As you just said with that trial there, I mean, that's what struck me. If you can essentially do this very targeted chemo or radiation therapy and then have these folks living that are all the way in stage 4, I mean, that's fantastic. Yeah. So yeah. I'm going to start to say,
honestly, what a journey, because you go back to in history, Marie Curie or the radium girls or whatever, where, you know, they got killed with radium.
Right.
I mean, it was, you know, right. And now to the point where actually, if you properly harness it and utilize it, it can be a cure for these things. It's kind of a crazy journey there. So,
yeah. And you guys are some of the only ones working on it. And that's, I think, where I'm going to wrap up. So,
okay.
What we've learned today is, you're one of, not one of, you're the largest producer of uranium in the United States, I believe.
Yep.
You're the only domestic producer of heavy rare earths. I don't think yep. lots of folks know that, right? They always gravitate nope. to the MP name and then skip over mm-hmm. energy fuels. You've yep. already been Fast 41 selected for Roca Honda. Sounds like you've been spending a lot of time in DC and are fairly confident they're going to keep partnering with companies like yours who can produce these critical minerals and metals. And then you have the blue sky there with the medical isotopes. I think that's a pretty quick snapshot of the reasons that I'm a shareholder, the reasons that I've been recommending Energy Fuels all year, and why I wanted to talk to you on this podcast. So again, I know it's been a while since we caught up, but it was great to geek out with you for 35 minutes or whatever on uranium and rare earths and yttrium and terbium and europium and all that good stuff. So yep. I'll give you the last word, and just know that I appreciate you coming on.
Oh no, it's great to see you again, Nick. It's been a little while. Hopefully we can do a few more of these things. It's an exciting time at Energy Fuels. We're making some phenomenal progress, since I think still been sort of flying under the radar a little bit, but hopefully in the next several months, a lot more clarity is going to be, get out there to hopefully be very good for shareholders like you and me. So.
Perfect. Okay. Curtis, again, I appreciate it. This was the 343rd episode of Investing in Bizarro World. On behalf of myself, my absent partner, Gerardo Del Real, and Curtis Moore, the Senior VP of Marketing and Corp Dev at Energy Fuels, we'll see you next week.